It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. A report from the White House argues there are proven harms associated with overtreating children with medications for depression or attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, also known as ADHD.
Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s Make America Healthy Again report blames ultra-processed foods, environmental chemicals, lack of physical activity, chronic stress, and excessive use of prescription drugs as culprits for causing chronic diseases in children.
This comes as the Trump administration has placed drugs for ADHD under additional scrutiny, with Kennedy claiming the medications are overprescribed and, quote, poisoning children.
To learn more about the latest research and treatment for ADHD, which affects more than 10% of kids nationwide, we're joined by a Wisconsin clinical psychologist. James Lee is the A.A. Alexander Associate Professor of Psychology and an investigator at the Waisman Center at UW-Madison. James, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you so much for having me.
How would you describe the ADHD diagnosis and how that definition is thought about today versus how it's changed over the decades?
Well, ADHD stands for Attention Deficit Hyperactivity Disorder, and it's a disorder that's characterized by developmentally inappropriate levels of inattention and hyperactivity. It's typically diagnosed in kids, as generally we would see these sort of symptoms emerge early in life. It's what's called a neurodevelopmental disorder. And so what that means is that it's believed to have very early origins that have a strong biological component to it. And I think your question in terms of how it's changed over time is that at least in the last 20, 25 years, our understanding, our definition of what ADHD is hasn't really changed. However, what has changed is our awareness of it, parents' recognition of it as a problem that can be treated. And a lot more kids these days are being diagnosed with it as prevalence rates have risen pretty drastically over the last 25 years. So while we haven't really changed much in our, at least the field's view of what it is, certainly most people, or at least a lot more people these days, are aware of it.
And we're going to get more into the prevalence, but is there a reliable test to diagnose it in clinic?
Yeah, so the way that ADHD diagnoses are done are usually very multifactorial. So what that means is that you actually need a lot of different types of tests and instruments in order to do it correctly, which I would say not everyone typically does because of how much is required. So generally speaking, in order to be following best practices for the diagnosis, you have to do an interview with the caregiver in the case of a child. So that usually entails asking a series of questions related to the presence of a number of symptoms related to ADHD and to what extent are they present in multiple settings, as ADHD is a disorder that needs to be present in not just at home or at school, but in multiple places. It also requires some level of observation. So generally that would look like a clinician who might go into a classroom and actually observe the child to see whether or not some of the symptoms that are reported are also there in front of their eyes. And also there's a component of neuropsych testing as well. This is where the child might come in for a number of hours and take some tests to assess their level of attention on a number of lab-based tests. And all of these different measures are supposed to be gathered and then shown to be reliable in terms of to what extent is there impairment across all of these different measures for ADHD.
You know, boys are more likely to be diagnosed, although that might be changing from what I understand. Why are there gender differences?
Yeah, that's the $5 million question of our science is why are there gender differences, not only in ADHD, but in so many of the neurodevelopmental disorders? You know, there's a lot of theories and hypotheses as to why there might be gender differences. Some of the leading ones include the fact that there might just be sort of a societal appreciation or maybe underappreciation for ADHD symptoms in girls. Inattention might resemble or what we think of like anxiety symptoms. So girls tend to be more likely to be diagnosed with anxiety disorders, whereas boys might be more likely to be diagnosed with ADHD, even though what is apparent could be very similar. It just looks like a kid who's, you know, daydreaming and not really focused on school. And so that could really be more of a societal bias around how teachers and parents kind of view these sorts of things. From a biological standpoint, there really hasn't been any compelling lines of evidence from brain imaging studies to genetics that suggest that there could be different, you know, regions of the brain that are lighting up that might, have us see more boys be diagnosed than girls. And there could be a lot of other reasons too, but these are sort of the two lines that have been most studied. And right now the most compelling line seems to be more of the societal bias around how inattention generally looks in boys relative to girls.
So as of 2022, more than 9% of children took medication for mental health or concentration. Those are CDC numbers. Do you think are too many children taking medication for ADHD?
I think that we might have an issue where we are not sure exactly what the true rate of ADHD is. And so the idea of over-medicalizing or over-prescribing ADHD medications is really difficult to come to, because you first have to know what exactly is the true rate of ADHD in the population. And because we've worked so hard in our field as mental health scientists and practitioners to sort of break down the stigma of mental illness and to sort of encourage parents and children to get help for mental health concerns, including ADHD, it's really unclear as to whether or not these rising rates of medication and diagnoses are actually supposed to be what we're observing. Is in fact, maybe we're trying to get to a point that needs to be higher because that's what the true rate is. On the other hand, maybe we are over-diagnosing and over-medicalizing ADHD. And I think that's right now an open question, because we just don't know what the true rate of ADHD really is.
So then why are stimulants like Adderall and Ritalin and others, why are they an effective way to treat and to manage ADHD?
There are basically two types of medications that are widely used to treat ADHD at this time. So one line that you've referred to are what are called stimulants, and they're the ones that are most well studied. Stimulant medications all work very similarly. They're basically a class of drugs that target two neurotransmitters in the brain. They're dopamine and norepinephrine. And the reason why they're so effective at treating symptoms of ADHD, specifically in attention and focus, is because they target the parts of the brain that regulate executive functions, decision-making, also working memory and focus. So that's what dopamine does. It's a sort of like the reward chemical of your brain, and it kind of lights up whenever we, you know, do something that we're really interested in. And so by targeting this particular pathway, we're able to, you know, light up the parts of our brain that's focusing on whatever it is that we're focusing on better. And the other neurotransmitter is norepinephrine, which has a sort of similar neurochemical component to it than as dopamine. It's the reason why these drugs are so instantaneous as well. Stimulant medications generally work within the hour as soon as they're taken. And by taking stimulant medications, especially these days, the medications that are on the market, they are pretty long lasting. So they actually can last for the whole day before the effects start to wear off. But you do have to take these medications on a daily basis. The downside of these types of medications, though, is that A, you have to take them every day for the efficacious effects to take hold. But B, there is an abuse potential associated with these particular drugs. They're called stimulants for a reason. And that also means that people who don't have ADHD can very easily misuse them, can abuse them and use them for other, you know, non-prescription reasons and get a hold of them in sort of illicit sort of ways. And so this is one of the reasons why they're so highly regulated, is because of the abuse potential. But when they're prescribed and used, with the prescription, they're only prescribed and used at a dosage that's meant to be therapeutic and have a very low potential for abuse when they're used therapeutically.
We're talking about one of the neurodevelopmental disorders, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, ADHD. James Lee is here, the A.A. Alexander Associate Professor of Psychology and investigator at the Waisman Center at UW-Madison. James, we heard Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr., who has claimed that environmental factors may be behind the rise in autism and other illnesses. How do environmental factors affect the likelihood of someone developing ADHD?
I mean, that's a very large component of what underlies the development of ADHD over time, is not just your biology and your genetics, which of course does play a huge role, but so does your environment and the environment that you're raised in. So from the research that I've done in my lab, we've shown that parenting style, parenting behaviors, parental monitoring plays a pretty big role in affecting the way that your genes work, the genes that you might carry for ADHD, that they're more likely to be expressed under environmental conditions that are, let's say, a little bit more lax or perhaps adverse. We've also found in my lab that exposures to early childhood traumas and early childhood adversities also increases a child's risk for developing ADHD. And again, this is in concert with their biology, looking alongside their genes. So it's really a matter of not just one or the other, which I think our health secretary seems to be conflating, saying that it's really more of an environmental thing. It's both. It's the, and not just both, it's the interactions between the two and how these, how your biology and your genetics interacts with the environments that you're in.
So that said, how could parents and caregivers in that child's life create a more supportive environment so the child can really complete their tasks and succeed better with ADHD?
Yeah, one of the empirically supported treatments, psychosocial treatments for ADHD, is what's called parent management training. And it's very effective. And in fact, it's part of the American Academy of Pediatrics guidelines for treatment providers who are working with parents with kids with suspected ADHD is a parent management form of training. And this type of intervention focuses mostly on teaching parents how to reinforce pro-social behaviors while also teaching them skills to manage some of those more maladaptive type of behaviors like fidgeting, not sitting still, not paying attention. A lot of these things are, in fact, of course, behavioral and can be managed with some good old-fashioned behavioral interventions, which have been around for a very long time and are quite efficacious. Where medications could be also useful is that they can enhance a lot of these behavioral interventions at the home and even at school. But to say that just medications alone are efficacious is actually incorrect. The recommendation by the American Academy of Pediatrics is, in fact, both of these in tandem with one another are quite efficacious. But as I just explained, changing the environment is a pretty big component of treating ADHD. It's not just the biology component.
As you mentioned, those early interventions could include prescriptions. And Health Secretary Kennedy has said, you know, called prescription stimulants harmful, saying children have been, quote, poisoned by taking these medications. What is your response to his concerns about prescriptions?
My response is that there is absolutely no scientific basis for any of those statements. Those who have studied this and who have spent many decades studying ADHD and other neurodevelopmental disorders know the evidence is quite clear that the medications that are currently FDA approved and prescribed to treat ADHD in particular are fairly well tolerated. They don't lead to early mortality, or at least there's no evidence of that. And they are generally very beneficial when used properly, under doctor's orders, of course, and in conjunction with high quality psychosocial interventions like parent management training. So I do agree, maybe not necessarily directly with the health secretary's statements about toxicity about medications, but at least with the idea that environment does play a pretty substantial role in mental health conditions in children. But it shouldn't be the only thing that we think about when it comes to intervention. It should be in concert with how we can also address the underlying biology that we currently know of that's quite relevant to these disorders.
So what I'm hearing is that genetics has a role. You know, your genes are expressing, and then also that interacts with the environment around you.
That's absolutely right, yeah. Mm-hmm. And genes actually, to put it into some perspective, for ADHD, based on about 25 years of twin literature and recent genome-wide association studies, it's estimated that genes explain something like 70 to 80% of the variation underlying ADHD, which means that genetics play a outsized role in the contributions to the cause of ADHD over time. Now, as I mentioned earlier, just because you carry the genes for ADHD doesn't mean that they'll be expressed. And that's epigenetics is helping us to better understand how do we know which genes get expressed and which don't. And that's really what we're learning from doing these studies of gene-environment interactions, is that these stressful environments can actually exacerbate our underlying genetic risks. If we carry these genetic risks, it's probably best if we can intervene early at the environmental level so that we maybe don't need to access, you know, medications younger in life, right? That would be preferred, of course. But again, to sort of conflate ADHD or autism as strictly an environmentally caused condition, I think is not rooted in any sort of scientific reality.
James Lee, where is the research headed in ADHD? What does Waisman Center want to focus on next?
That's a great question. So right now we have a very big study that's looking at ADHD as a co-occurring condition with other neurodevelopmental disorders. I've mentioned this earlier, but ADHD is part of a constellation of other conditions in the DSM that are called neurodevelopmental disorders. Included in them is autism. And we know that among the autistic community, roughly 50% of them struggle with ADHD and ADHD-like traits. It's one of the biggest co-occurring conditions that autistic individuals struggle with the most. And we know very little about how to treat ADHD in individuals who have these co-occurring conditions like autism. One of the really disappointing things about the ADHD research is that it's been primarily focused on individuals who've been screened for and specifically meet criteria for ADHD and only ADHD, which means that for a large subset of individuals out there who might carry co-occurring conditions, including ADHD, we just really don't know if these treatments are even efficacious for them at all. And that's specifically, I'm referring to autistic individuals. So the really compelling finding that led us to do our research on this group of autistic individuals with ADHD is that there's a meta-analysis that came out a couple years ago that showed that autistic kids who were given stimulant medications to treat their ADHD symptoms actually had more adverse events and adverse risk profiles as a result of taking these medications, which are FDA approved and supposed to be safe. But these autistic kids who were given these medications actually did not fare better, and in many cases actually fared worse because they experienced a lot more adverse risk profiles as a result of taking the medication, which would suggest that these traditional medications that we're using to treat ADHD may not actually be effective in treating ADHD for certain individuals. So that's sort of where the field is headed, is thinking about ADHD not just as its own thing, but kind of as part of other co-occurring conditions for which ADHD tends to show up in so many different conditions as well.
James, thank you so much for the conversation. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
That is clinical psychologist James Lee, the A.A. Alexander Associate Professor of Psychology and an investigator at the Waisman Center at UW-Madison. We've been talking about the latest research and treatment for ADHD as the White House scrutinizes the medications used to treat the disorder in children.